Sam Two Wolves woke feeling like his head had been split completely in two, and that now the two separate pieces were competing to see which could hurt the worse. He was lying on a stone floor, and must have been there for some time, because the stone had more or less warmed to his body temperature underneath him. He tried to touch his pounding scalp so as to investigate the damage there. Tried. That was all. Tried. He could not reach up that high. His hands, it seemed, were shackled, locked into steel manacles that were linked by stout chains. Sam sat up. He managed, but it took him several tries. He was weak and dizzy. It did not help that his feet were chained, too. Wrist chains and leg chains joined by yet another length of chain. By sitting cross-legged on the floor and bending low, he was able to get one hand high enough to touch the back of his head. He could feel crusted blood there, but not as much as he would have expected from the amount of pain. If there was any good news, it was that he did not feel any shifting bone under his probing fingertips. The skull seemed to be intact, even if painful. Satisfied at least about that, he was able to give some attention to his surroundings. He was in what surely was a jail cell with stone floor and stone walls. The cell was no more than 6 by 8 feet. A steel door closed off one end. The only furniture was a wooden bucket that lay on its side in a back corner. The ceiling, he could not see well enough in the gloom of the dark, airless cell to see the ceiling. Not that it would have made any difference. Trussed like he was not going anywhere, not on his own. Weary from the effort of sitting upright and examining the very small world around him, Sam lay back down and closed his eyes. He needed to rest, he knew. He needed to regain his strength. After a while, the throbbing pain receded a little, and he slept. Sam woke the next time as the door opened and the cell was flooded with light. Two Mexican soldiers shouldered their way inside. The two bent and, each taking hold of him under his arms, lifted him onto his feet. He had no strength in his legs. The soldiers held him up between them and dragged Sam out of the cell and down a short corridor to a large room where more soldiers were gathered. Two of those were guarding a raggedly dressed civilian who showed the bruises of a beating. The man was dark, with hair worn long and tied back with a headband Apache style. He had distinctively Indian cheekbones. It was not possible to see what color his eyes were, as they were swollen almost completely closed by the beating he had suffered. Standing by a front window were the officer Sam remembered seeing earlier. Antonio, the bartender had called him, and a slender, very handsomely dressed gentleman with sandy hair and a pencil mustache. The American crossed the room to closely inspect first the Indian prisoner and then Sam. He looked disappointed, but after a few moments nodded and stepped away to confer with Antonio out of Sam's earshot. The two of them seemed to reach some sort of agreement, although one that neither was completely happy with. The gent removed a coin purse from his coat pocket and selected a few yellow pieces that he gave to Antonio. The lieutenant nodded briskly, then gestured to his men. Sam and the Indian were hauled outside and tossed, still in chains, into a steel cage that sat on the bed of a freight wagon pulled by a team of heavy draft horses.
"Take them out to the diggings, then come back here. I have some more work for you."
Sam could not get a good look at the man with the reins. Not that it likely mattered. Not right now. The only thing he was sure of at the moment was that he was in a pickle. Right now, he needed to concentrate on recouping his strength and regaining his freedom. Matt Bodine followed the wagon road around a curve and broke out over a wide bench on a hillside. Below it lay brown miles of rough, rolling countryside. Above it, a string of low mountains with dark foliage spotting the slopes and filling in the niches. Cattle grazed in the distance. On the bench itself was an adobe house, a log barn, a grouping of smaller outbuildings, and a set of corrals. A thin stream trickling down from the mountain above fed a stock pond before running off toward the flats, and Matt could see the stub of a water sump uphill from the house, with pipe feeding into the back of the house. Now that was a mighty convenient touch, he thought. Water flowing fresh and clean right there inside the house. What would they think of next? But where did it go after it got inside? He could not see any outflow below the house. Surely the water had to go somewhere. Matt rode into the yard of Peter Branville's Bar PB and drew rein in front of the house.
Hello? Is anyone home? Hello in there?
He remained in the saddle until a slender, very pretty Mexican woman in an apron and with her sleeves rolled up came in response to his call.
Sí, señor?
Matt swept his hat off and flashed his most charming smile. This was a very pretty woman indeed, and about his own age.
Do you speak English, miss? I'm looking for a Mr. Branville. This is his place, isn't it?
Yes, I speak English. And yes, this is his place. Peter is not here at the moment, but I expect him very soon.
Well, then perhaps I could water this horse, miss, and wait for Pete.
You may water your animal, sir. The trough is over there. It would not be proper for you to remain here without the presence of my husband, though.
Your husband, ma'am?
I am Senora Branville.
Matt could not help but admire the pride and defiance in her voice.
You're Pete's missus? I'm awful pleased to meet you, ma'am. My name is Matt Bodine. And if you don't mind, I'd like you to tell me where I can find Pete and my brother Sam.
Peter is not here, and you say you have a brother named Sam?
That's right, ma'am. Pete sent a letter asking the two of us to come here. He didn't say why exactly, but he said he needed help. Where is he, anyhow? And Sam, where'd my brother get to?
I have never met this brother of yours, Senor Bodine, I believe you said. I do not know any Sam Bodine, and I cannot tell you where my husband is.
Sam's last name is Two Wolves, ma'am. We're actually blood brothers, not birth brothers. And
blood brothers? From Wyoming in the United States, yes? Peter did mention you. He said you would help us. Now, it may be too late for you to help.
I don't understand.
My husband disappeared 6 days ago, Mr. Bodine. He rode out that morning like he always does. He did not come home that night.
And you say you don't know Sam?
That is correct, yes.
Sam should have been ahead of me maybe as much as 2 days, ma'am. I was sure I'd find him here already.
No, I have not seen him. I am sorry.
I don't like the sound of any of this, ma'am. Look, can I step down from this saddle and see to the horse? We've come a long way and he's nigh wore out.
Excuse me, please. Where are my manners? There is a little grain in the barn. Give him that. Then come back here. You must be hungry, too.
Don't mean to put you to any trouble, but I do want to ask you about the trouble Pete needs our help with. I sure would like to know what's become of Sam, though. I have a bad feeling about him. About Pete, too.
Take care of the horse, Mr. Bodine. I will have food ready when you are done with him. We will talk then.
It was a marvel, that's what it was. Just like Sam said they had back east. Pete had fixed up the outflow pipe from his spring box with a brass screw valve sort of thing. When you wanted water, all you had to do was turn the handle and open that valve. When you were done, you turned it back the other way to stop the water from flowing. No wonder he hadn't seen any outflow from the house. There was even a collector pipe sort of thing built into the bottom of a sump so the water would flow out if you wanted it to, like when you were done with it. Anita wouldn't even have to carry her used dishwater outside when she was done. She could just unplug that pipe and the water would run out to somewhere. Matt hadn't figured that out yet. He stood at the sink and turned the water on, and then off again probably a half dozen times before he was satisfied that he understood what Pete had worked out here. Anita stood aside and watched him with a small smile. She probably had seen this sort of reaction from visitors a good many times before. Lunch was tortillas and spicy refried beans, Mexican style. There was no meat. Matt suspected the Branvilles could not afford the luxury of butchering their own beeves, and there were neither pigs nor chickens on the place. The household garden, watered by the same creek that came down close by the house, produced mostly corn, beans, and peppers, and was the likely source of the food Anita served now.
This is good, ma'am. Thanks.
It is not too hot for you. It is all right to tell me if so. I understand that you Americans have not the stomach of us peons.
It's fine, ma'am. You say you haven't seen or heard from my brother Sam, and you don't know what's happened to Pete either?
No, Senor Bodin. I wish I could tell you, but I do not know.
I'll be looking for both of them, then. Could you tell me, though, what trouble you and Pete are having here? Could you tell me why he wrote saying he needed help?
There is a man, an Americano. He has taken a dislike to my husband. I do not know why he would do this.
Me neither, ma'am. I admit it's been a while since either me or Sam saw Pete, but when we knew him, he was an awful likable fella. Easygoing and always with a smile.
Anita gave a shy smile of her own, which caused dimples to appear on either side of her mouth.
He still smiles, my wonderful husband. His smile was what I first noticed about him. He made my heart full then. He still does.
Pete was a mighty lucky fellow, Matt thought. Mighty lucky indeed.
Tell me about this man. You don't know what it is between him and Pete?
No, not really. Peter, I think he does not want to worry me.
Anita laid a hand flat on the front of her apron, and her smile this time was positively beatific.
We will be blessed with a little one, God willing.
She nodded happily, then sobered again.
Peter worries about my condition, as if it was an illness, you know?
That's kind of the American way. With us men folk, anyway. Women seem to take to the notion easier than their husbands do.
That is true on this side of the border, too. Perhaps that is why Peter has not wanted to say much about our troubles.
But this man, what can you tell me about him?
He owns much land to the north and west. He owns many hectares.
He raises cattle?
Who knows what he does. But he is a great friend of the governor of this state and of the military commander over the district. I know this to be true because before he came, we were wanted here. Our business was desired. Not so now. Since this man came, we have no friends in Saniba. The stores do not really wish to trade with us. They will sell us things, but for cash only. There is no credit while waiting for the calf crop to be sold. You know what I am saying. Do they have credit on the north of the border?
You bet they do. It's the usual way of getting along. Folks gotta live while they're waiting for money to come in. Then when they sell their beeves, they go right away and pay off whatever they owe and set aside what they have left over to get them through the winter. Most of the time, that ain't quite enough to carry them, so they got to run a tab again, just the same as here.
This man, I think he wants to make us leave. Peter has not told me this, but I believe it.
What's this man's name, ma'am?
Please, call me Anita. You make me sound so old.
I'll try, Anita. Now, who is this American who doesn't like Pete?
His name is Gerald Williams. Do you know of him?
No, I've never heard of him. But I guess I'll find out what I can.
There is something you should know.
I'm listening.
3 times. It could be more. Peter was troubled when he returned home. He did not say what was wrong, but he never used to carry a gun before this Williams came here. After the 2nd time that Peter was so worried, he found his revolver in the chest where he had placed it out of sight. He cleaned it and loaded it and began to carry it with him whenever he rode away from the house, just to go down to the birthing pasture even. He never told me why he did this, but I am his wife. I knew that he was troubled.
We'll try and get to the bottom of it.
Anne tried to find out what had happened to Sam, too. Horse trouble, Matt hoped. Nothing more serious than more horse trouble. Matt sure did wish the two of them hadn't gotten split up like this, though. He was worried about Pete, but about Sam as well. He dug into what remained of his dinner, wanting to surround it in a hurry so he could get about the business of trying to unravel this knot with Pete and Sam and a man named Gerald Williams. The diggings, that fellow back in town had said. Sam understood what he meant now. The term was a description as well as a place. The diggings was a mine, a deep, open-pit mine gouged out of solid rock. It was being dug deeper and rock extracted by 7 men. Just 7, Sam noted. Considering the size of the pit and the amount of work to be done, there should have been several times that number of miners doing the digging. Yet there were only seven. Sam and his companion in the prison wagon clearly were intended to be the eighth and ninth miners in this hot and airless hole. The seven who were down there were chained, although not with the manacles and leg irons that Sam wore now. The miners wore balls and chains, single ankle rings attached to 4 feet or so of chain with an iron ball at the end of it. The balls, which looked like solid shot for a cannon, were roughly a foot in diameter and must have been terribly heavy. The miners could move almost freely within the limits of their chains, but if they wanted to go more than a pace or two beyond that, they had to pick the balls up and carry them with them, cupping both hands together and nestling the balls against their bellies, the weight of the metal making their movement more of a waddle than a walk. Six of the men were attacking the rock with large, pick-like tools, heavy enough to shatter the stone into shards and splinters. They needed their hands free for the work, and they needed to brace their feet wide apart in order to maintain their balance. That would account for the balls and chains. If they were chained like Sam was now, they would not be able to work in the pit. The seventh was engaged in collecting the broken scraps of stone produced by the other six. The man had a wheelbarrow. He carried his iron ball in it, along with whatever sort of ore they were extracting here. Sam watched as he took the wheelbarrow across the jagged, lumpy floor of the pit to a station against the wall, where he transferred the rock chips into an iron bucket at the bottom of a chain hoist that would lift the ore to the surface whenever the overseers wished. There were three overseers visible, none of them actually down inside the pit. Two of the men, both of whom were white Americans, were armed with revolvers and shotguns. The third carried only a rod or cane no thicker than a man's little finger, a thin and whippy and rather ineffectual-looking thing that this one, a tall and very rugged-looking individual, swished back and forth through the air. It was this man, who obviously was in charge, who came to meet the prison wagon.
Tumore. Good. It's about time we got replacements for those we lost this past month.
The overseer motioned for one of the shotgun guards to join him, then came to the rear of the wagon. He unlocked the cage and beckoned for Sam and the other man to come out. Sam was acutely conscious of the shackles that weighed him down and severely restricted his movement. But he suspected the relative freedom of a single chain with an iron ball at the other end of it would be no improvement over what he suffered now. He crawled slowly out of the cage. He had to turn and back carefully down to the ground like an infant just learning to go down stair steps. It was humiliating, in addition to the physical annoyance. Finally, however, he did manage to stand clear of the wagon. He waited there while the Indian who had been his unspeaking companion for the hours-long journey crawled out too. The man with the cane, it was made of bamboo, Sam could see when he got closer, waited until they were both out, then motioned for the driver to pull away, which he quickly did. Then the overseer turned to the chained prisoners.
Do you understand English? Not if you know what I'm saying.
Sam nodded. The Indian beside him did not. The overseer pointed to Sam.
You say you speak English, do you?
Sam nodded again.
Good.
He pointed to the Indian.
You, turn around and present your back.
The Indian did not move or give any indication of understanding the instruction. The overseer's lips thinned in what may have been intended as a smile.
We shall see, laddie. We shall see. Turn him around, Bobby.
The guard motioned for the Indian to turn, and the man immediately faced away from the overseer.
Down.
When the Indian stood unmoving, the guard stepped closer and, using the barrel of his shotgun, whacked the back of the Indian's knees, buckling his legs. Bobby moved closer and shoved, driving the chained man to his knees. Then Bobby pushed on the back of the Indian's head until he was bowed low and facing away from the overseer.
Listen to me, laddie. I'll be doing something now that you'll not like even a little, but I shall stop. This one time will I stop, if only you ask me to. Do you understand? All you need to do to make me stop is to say the word, and there'll be no more. Do you understand that, eh?
The Indian was motionless.
I told you fair now, didn't I?
The bamboo cane flashed in the overseer's hand. The ends moved slightly apart when it passed through the air. Sam had not noticed that the cane, or flail, he supposed it might be called, was split until the overseer struck with it.
Just say the word, laddie, when you want me to stop.
The back of the Indian shirt split open under the sharp impact, and there were already bright red welts rising where the bamboo struck.
Stop! Please stop!
The overseer winked at Bobby, smiling evilly.
Surprising, isn't it? How many of them learn the king's English so sudden-like? All right, lad. We've both proved our point. You can turn around and stand up now.
The Indian climbed to his feet.
My name is Case Wilhelm. Boss Wilhelm to the likes of you. You can call me that, or boss, or sir. Call me anything else, and you'll feel the cut of my lovely flail. Step out of line in any way, and you shall feel its sting. In a minute, you'll be fitted with your ankle chain and a wee anchor. The only way that chain will come off once it's on is to cut your foot off. But any time you want the chain off, you just let me know. I will personally remove it for you. You're here to do a job. That's all. Just a job. Your sentence is 18 months. I'll write down in the book the date of your arrival. 18 months from now, exactly, you will be given a lunch and a dollar and set free. Until then, you'll perform hard labor. Very hard. No doubt about it. Very hard labor. And you will not like it. That is too bad, but you have no choice. You'll serve every day of your lawful sentence, make no mistake. If you cause trouble, you'll be caned. Try and run, and the guards have authority to shoot. Think about that before you try anything. Now I want you to go with Bobby here. He'll take you to the smithy. When you have your ankle chains, he'll show you how to get into the pit where you'll be given tools and start to work off your sentences. And from this moment on, I will tolerate no complaints. Take what you're given. Give back an honest effort, and we'll have no problems, you and me. But woe on you if you cause me trouble or torment, for I promise that I can give back more than you want to bear. Now follow Bobby there to the smithy.
Wilhelm turned away, then stopped and spun back to face them. The evil, mirthless grin flashed again.
One thing I forgot to mention. Whenever I walk near, you turn away and drop to your knees. Every time. Every time.
Wilhelm marched away, back stiff and shoulders squared like a military officer out of uniform. Sam glanced back into the pit where the seven prisoners continued to labor without any outward show of curiosity, although they surely had to know that there were newcomers up above them at ground level.
Come along now, no lollygagging, this way!
Sam and the Indian shuffled along as fast as they were able. By the time Sam and the Indian were securely fitted with their restraints, it was nearly dusk and too late for them to go down into the pit.
Grab up those anchors and follow me! Quick now!
Sam realized they were not going anywhere quickly the first time he bent and retrieved the ball. He was not sure what the solid iron sphere weighed, but his best guess would be in the neighborhood of 40 pounds, more or less. Light enough to drag or to carry, heavy enough to severely hamper movement, especially when the 4-foot-long chain was part of the problem. Things would have been much easier had the chain been just a foot or two longer, long enough to reach chest high or a little more so he could carry the ball on or over his shoulder. But of course, there was a reason why the chain was not long enough for a man to do that, for it would make movement easier. And the whole idea of the ball and chain was to inhibit rapid movement, running away, for instance, without curtailing slow and deliberate motion. Sam found that he could pick the ball up by the chain and carry it in one hand, but it was much easier to carry it in both hands cradled against his belly, exactly the way he had already observed the other prisoners doing down in the pit. Sam and the Indian waddled after Bobby to what looked like a root or storage cellar that had been dug into a solid rock hillside. A heavy door closed off the front. The door was wood, Sam noted, already thinking of escape. But it was secured by 4 thick iron bars that could be put in place to stop anyone from opening it. At least, he saw when they stepped inside, they did not have to worry about being trapped by fire. The prison chamber was 5 feet wide and 6 high and ran too deep into the hillside for light to penetrate. Sam guessed it was an abandoned mine tunnel. No, dang it, that was not the correct word. He had to search his memory for a moment to come up with the right term. An adit, that was it. An adit runs into the ground. A tunnel runs all the way through and emerges on the other side. Sam wondered if this might indeed be a tunnel, if there might be an other side to find and escape through. Pallets consisting of lumpy mattress tickings and ragged blankets showed this to be the living quarters of the captive laborers. A pair of oak buckets set near the doorway were provided for personal needs. There were no other furnishings, no lamps or candles, and no sign of personal possessions either, he noticed. No spare clothing, no books or combs or razors. Bobby pushed them inside. Sam noticed that the door was only barred once. Bobby trusted them to stay put. Or possibly the guard knew something that Sam and his Indian companion did not. The only light inside the adit now was the little that seeped in around the edges of the door. There was no window in it and no source of light deeper inside the mountain. Sam closed his eyes, standing rigid with the iron ball against his belly completely forgotten. He raised his face toward the unseen sky and began to breathe the unspoken words of an ancient chant. Strength was what he summoned from his ancestors and from the spirits of these foreign mountains. Strength and patience. Sam suspected he would be needing both of those. When he opened his eyes again, he felt lightheaded but calm. He grunted again and took a step forward, the movement causing him to remember the ball in his hands. It suddenly felt impossibly heavy, and he set it down beside his right foot.
You all right now?
Sam blinked. He had to look carefully in the gloom to see that the speaker was the Indian who had traveled here with him from San Iba. Sam shivered, throwing off the last vestiges of the trance he had gone into.
Fine, thanks.
You were gone a very long time.
I intend to be gone much longer than that, starting at the first opportunity.
What language you pray in, brother?
Cheyenne.
I am Yaqui.
I have heard of your people, your warriors.
The Yaqui have heard of the Cheyenne.
My name is Sam Two Wolves.
I am Blue Runner. I am of the Snake Clan, Two Wolf. I never know a Cheyenne warrior until now.
Perhaps we will have a chance to fight side by side, Blue Runner. Perhaps we will do this when my brother comes to get me.
You have a brother? Here?
Close by. Somewhere close by, Blue Runner. I can feel his presence.
He will come?
He is my brother. He will come. As surely as I would come for him, friend, he will come.
Blue Runner's smile flashed white in the gloom.
Good.
Matt borrowed the use of one of Pete Branville's horses and saddled it, leaving his own weary nag in the corral. Pete's sorrel was young and fractious, but it was a pretty thing. Matt always had a weakness for beauty, in horses as well as in women. The sorrel was an honest creature. It waited until Matt was firmly seated before it blew up. It exploded in all directions at once. At least that was what it felt like. Matt's head flopped and wobbled like a chicken with a broken wing, and his spine felt like it was being played like an accordion, shoved down short whenever the sorrel's hooves pounded into the ground, stretched almost to breaking every time it reached the top of a jump and started down again while Matt was still going up. The horse could likely buck a tick off its back, or anyway thought it could. It did its level best to unseat Matt. He had to cling tight with everything he had. If he could have gotten a mouthful of mane between his teeth, he would have hung on with them, too. Even if that interfered with the grin on his face, he was thoroughly enjoying the contest. The sorrel worked him over for what seemed a terrible amount of time, but probably was no more than a minute or two to anyone who might have been a dispassionate observer. Like the kid that was standing in the house doorway, hair tousled and eyes full of sleep. Matt recalled then that Peter's letter had mentioned a son. Probably the kid had been down for a nap when Matt got there. The boy looked to be 3 or maybe 4, and he was certainly enjoying the show that Matt and the sorrel put on for him. Matt rode the horse down to an agreeable settlement, then waved to the kid, who got bug-eyed and shy once he was caught watching. The child darted out of sight. The horse settled onto all four feet, shook itself like a dog coming out of water, and bobbed its head. Matt lightly squeezed with his knees, and the sorrel stepped out in as pretty a road gait as he'd ever ridden.
Fine horse. Wonder if Pete would be willing to sell it.
But first, he had to find Pete and Sam. Wherever Sam was, whatever had happened, Sam surely knew that Matt would be coming to find him. Matt took the sorrel down off the bench to a cattail-rimmed pond that was fed by the stream that passed by the house. A number of beeves bearing the Bar PB brand were lying in some scant shade nearby, looking for relief from the late afternoon heat. If a man lived in this country, Matt thought, he would surely want to hang up his Stetson in favor of a straw hat that would let a little air reach his scalp. Lordy, but it was hot down here. Matt chased the cattle away from their shade, dismounted, and tied the sorrel to one of the three scrawny, thorny, 20-foot-tall mesquites where the beeves had been. Manure, long since dried and scattered by trampling, showed that this was far from being the first time a horse had been tied here. No surprise, of course. Pete likely did the same often enough. And there was no way for Matt to read anything more than that into the fact, never mind that a host of Pete's enemies could have waited here for the young rancher to come down off the bench to check on his cattle. Even so, Matt walked over to the pond and carefully inspected the ground close to the water where hoof or footprints might have been left. The ground was thoroughly churned by prints, but none was helpful. Cattle made most of the tracks. So did a good many birds of various sizes, one raccoon or something very similar to one, coyotes, and either a very large lynx or a rather small mountain lion. There were no horse prints at all and no footprints left by boots. Matt checked both sides of the pond and both banks of the creek above the pond and along the very small outflow. The creek fizzled out and disappeared underground about 100 paces below the pond, leaving a narrow wash below that point, the wash scoured out by heavy runoff in the rare wet years. He walked back to the mesquites and reclaimed the sorrel. It offered no protest this time when he mounted, and rode it through the wash for a quarter mile until that intersected with a much larger gully. He found a few prints here and there, but they indicated only one horse and thus very likely were Pete's tracks, left while he was working his own cattle and not by someone who intended to waylay him. Matt scrambled out of the wash onto the flat above using one of the many trails created by wild game or by cattle. It was late in the day, and he was no closer to knowing Pete's whereabouts or Sam's than when he arrived. Still, he had to look close to the ranch before he went off in other directions. And come to think of it, he remembered now, he hadn't thought to ask Anita Branville if Pete's horse came back home without him the day Pete disappeared. Matt turned the sorrel around and headed back to the ranch.
Yes, it did. But it returned 3 days later, and in its mane there were burrs of a kind that do not grow here.
The boy, named Ricardo in honor of Anita's father, stood huddled close to his mama's side with the thumb stuffed into the corner of his mouth.
Are you sure?
Señor Bodine, I am not a fool, and I grew up on a small farm. I know my father's land and what grows there. I know this land and what grows here. I myself searched carefully for my Peter. I listened for his cries for help or for the sound of coyotes saying they found food. I watched the sky for the sight of vultures gathering. And until he returned, I looked for his horse. It was nowhere on our land or close to it. When the horse did come back, I looked at it carefully before I groomed it and put it into the corral. This horse, it was the same that you chose to ride today. When I found it standing outside the corral close by to the feed trough, it had burrs in its mane and a few in its tail, and there was dried mud above the hocks. This mud was gray, not the black mud of a meadow, nor the yellow mud you see sometimes when there is wetness on the land below here on our land. The gray mud, I think it must come from a mountain, Senor Bodin.
Matt turned to look toward the mountain that loomed above the Branville homestead.
No, not there, Senor. Peter would not go there. It is not our land, and there is a cliff, you would say? Acantilado?
Cliff.
Oh, yes, cliff. Sorry, thank you. My English, it is so...
It's fine, really. What about this cliff?
It is steep. Cows, even sheep, have no way to climb it. So Peter never needs to worry about our livestock straying in this direction. He would have no need to be there and no trail to use without traveling far around.
Yet the sorrel had gray mud dried on its legs?
Yes, senor. This must have come from a mountain. Maybe this one, maybe another. I could not say. But to reach this mountain behind this place, one must travel many miles to either side in order to go around the cliff.
I think tomorrow I'll ride back to San Iba. Maybe somebody's seen or heard something about Pete or about my brother. Surely somebody must know something.
Perhaps.
After a moment, Anita smiled and ruffled Ricardo's curly hair.
Come. You can help me set the table for our supper, eh? You will excuse us, Senor Bodin?
Matt nodded without really hearing what the woman said. His thoughts were elsewhere. Matt had to tilt his hat low to keep the sun out of his eyes as he rode into San Iba from the west. He had gotten an early start, not waiting for Anita Branville and the boy to wake up. Between his worry about Sam and his concern for Pete, he hadn't been able to sleep anyway. He saddled his own horse, rested and rode ready now, and headed out in the dark in order to get here early. The first order of business would be to find a bite of breakfast. The rumbling and grumbling in Matt's belly was telling him it was past time for that. Matt drew rein in the middle of the street. There was not enough traffic in the sleepy town for that to cause any obstruction, and surveyed the possibilities. A hotel called the Cattleman's Inn looked promising. There was an outdoor patio with tables that suggested they provided meals for their guests, and a big breakfast was just what he needed. Besides, it would give him an opportunity to start asking about Sam. He dismounted and led the horse to a public water trough, gave it a moment to drink, and then tied it to a street-side hitch rail before walking back to the hotel. The man behind the counter smiled and nodded when Matt came in.
Morning, friend. What can I do for you?
Do you serve meals here?
Meals, rooms, liquor, pretty much anything a man needs.
Matt crossed the lobby to offer a smile and a handshake.
I'm hungry as a bear in springtime, mister. Trot out two of everything on the menu, please.
The fellow stepped into the kitchen for a moment, then returned.
The boy will have it out quick as it's ready.
Thanks. There's something else I'd like to ask while I'm waiting for the food.
Sure. Ask anything you like. I'll either tell you God's honest truth or a really good lie.
I'm looking for my brother. He should have come through here a few days ago. I don't know if he would have stayed the night, but if I know Sam, he would have been powerful hungry by the time he got down here. He's about the same height as me. Even looks a fair amount like me, except he's got black hair and eyes and a darker complexion.
Your brother, you say? No, sir, I can't recall anyone like that. We don't get so awful many strangers here, white men in particular. I'd remember for certain sure if I saw him.
Thanks for trying to help. It was worth asking. Could I trouble you with one more question?
No trouble at all, friend. Go ahead.
Me and my brother are down here to see an old friend. I believe you might know him. Pete Branville.
Of course I know Pete. He's a good man. Good neighbor. Are you needing directions to his place? I've never been there myself, but Doc Tippett ought to be able to help you. Doc isn't a regular doctor, you understand. He doctors horses. Owns a livery stable down at the other end of town. I expect he'd know.
Oh, I know where to find the ranch. But Pete isn't there. Hasn't been for the past week or so.
I don't know as I can help you about that, then. I haven't seen Pete in, 3 or 4 weeks, I'd guess. Could be longer. He doesn't come into town except every now and then. You know how that is.
Yes, sir, I do. And I thank you for your help.
A slender Mexican boy of 15 or so came out of the back, carrying a wide, heavy-laden tray. The aromas coming off the plates on that tray were good enough to get Matt's saliva flowing and his stomach rumbling again.
You'd best pick a table and sit down if you want that breakfast, friend.
Matt was quick to take the innkeeper's advice. When he was done eating, It took a while, as there was a mountain of food there, and he was determined to get around as much of it as he could. Matt went next door to a pleasant little saloon. He figured there wasn't so much to San Eva. He could walk both sides of the business district asking for Sam and for Pete. Surely someone here must have seen Sam, even if he had only ridden through the town without stopping. Sam could have met someone on the road who gave him directions to the bar PB. He did not absolutely have to have stopped in San Eva, but he certainly had to ride through the town, if he got this far. Something could have happened to him before he ever arrived in the vicinity. Matt's stomach lurched and he felt a chill run up his spine at that thought. Sam might have been waylaid on the road, between here and the border, up in Arizona somewhere, any place. Matt shook his head and scowled. No. If Sam, for some reason, was ambushed and murdered, Matt would know it. The connection between them was strong enough that Matt surely would feel it if Sam were killed. Sam Two Wolves was not dead. Matt knew that in his bones. But Sam was in trouble. Matt could feel that, too. Wherever Sam was, it was cause for worry. If he had to talk to every man, woman, and child in San Eva in his search for Sam, well, that was what he would do, starting with this quiet saloon. All seven of the prisoners led into the cave-like cell were Indians. No white men, Sam noticed, and no Mexicans either. Four of the men were Yaquis. They already knew Blue Runner and immediately drew him off and began conversing in their own language. The other three were Apache, Nana, Coronado, and Tomas. All nine men squatted close to the entrance, Sam and Blue Runner, because that was where they happened to be standing when the others were brought in, the seven experienced prisoners as if they were waiting for something.
What is it like here, Nana?
It is bad. Hard. Dig, dig, and more dig. Bossman wants a stone.
Do you know why? What kind of ore is it?
Who knows, huh? They're crazy in the head, these whites.
It was dark outside, but the night was far brighter than the inside of the cell, bright enough for Sam to see Wilhelm and a guard standing by with shotguns, while another guard brought in buckets that had been delivered on a hand-drawn wagon. There were nine of the galvanized steel buckets. One by one, the prisoners each retrieved a bucket until two were left. The Yaquis said something, and Blue Runner, too, took a bucket. Nana motioned for Sam to pick up the last. It was heavy, and there was a mighty good smell rising out of it.
Eat!
The massive door was pushed closed, blocking out all sight of the outside world and taking the light with it.
In the morning, they bring more food. Give this pot, exchange. You see?
Yes, I understand.
Little time to eat, then go dig. Two meal each day. Only water in pit. No food, no siesta. Just dig.
Sam tasted the rich stew. He had to scoop it with his fingers as there was no spoon provided. The stew was good, and there was plenty of it. It was not hot, but at least it was acceptably warm. Sam quickly learned that the easiest way to eat the stew was to raise the bucket and drink the stew rather than trying to scoop it up. He used his fingers to drag the chunks of meat, rice, and carrot to the lip of the bucket so he could get to those. As his eyes became adjusted to the lack of light, he saw that the others were doing much the same, except for Blue Runner, who sat with his bucket in his lap and ate with his hands. There was no provision for washing, at least none that Sam knew. He asked Coronado.
No, rub dirt, no water.
The accommodations here are not what a fellow might hope for, but at least they feed well. They aren't trying to starve anyone.
That must be strong. You need food to be strong so you can dig the stone for them.
I don't think I would like 18 months of this, though.
18?
That's how long my sentence is, or so they said. A year and a half, and I don't even know why. Did I say something funny?
18 months? Brother, no one lives so long here. You will be dead long before that. 8, 10 months, maybe so.
There was a man once who lived more than a year. That is what they say, but then they want you to believe this. Want you to believe he will live long enough to be set free. You will not. If you dig 18 months but still live, They will not allow you to go anyway. No one leaves here, except down the hill.
Down the hill? What hill? What does that mean?
Nana pointed toward the door and the free world beyond.
Down there, down the mountain, sometimes we turn the wheel. We break the stone, grind it like corn on the matate. You know what I am saying?
Yes, I think I do. Like grinding meal with a mill wheel.
Yes, Arastra grinds stone. We turn the wheel. Not so hard as to dig, so it is good to have this job. The sick are allowed to work at the Arastra. What is left after they take what they want from this small stone and dust, whatever is left is thrown over the side, thrown down the hill. When a man dies here, he too is thrown over the side, down the hill. Then soon the stone falls down. It covers him, and he is seen no more. That is what I mean by down the hill, Samtu Wolf.
Well, I don't know about you boys, but I intend to live and walk out of here a free man, and I don't expect to take any 18 months to do it.
If you find a way, good. But I must tell you, Samtu Wolf, we have looked for a way to leave. There's nothing.
Sam did not argue with the friendly Apache, but he did not agree with the man either. There was a way. He just did not know yet what it was. But he would. He was determined that he would. Living as wanderers had hardened the Blood Brothers and inured them to the hardships of living outdoors. Sleeping on the ground was normal for both of them, so much so that they could be comfortable anywhere. Or so Sam had believed until now. He woke the following morning and got a second sort of wake-up when he sat upright.
Oh!
He hurt. Darn near everywhere. His hips and shoulders ached from sleeping on hard, bare rock with no blanket to act as a pad between flesh and stone. His back hurt. His elbows hurt. The back of his head hurt. His ankle especially hurt from the steel shackle that encircled it.
Hey, Two-Wolf!
Sam was surprised that he was able to see fairly clearly in the gloom now that his eyes were so thoroughly adjusted.
Oh, good morning, Nana.
Your foot, it is sore? That where the metal touches?
Yes, very much so.
Be careful. If you pull too much, it will tear and bleed. Can become, infected?
Yes, that's the word. Infected.
I have seen men's foot rot from the infected. They get the stinking flesh, and then they die. Tear the bottom of your shirt. Push that between the metal and the meat. It will help.
Thank you.
The others picked up the food buckets they had been given the evening before, so Sam did the same. The door swung open, admitting a rush of pale gray pre-dawn light. One by one, the men exchanged their empty buckets for full ones and quickly retreated.
Not long time. They're back soon.
Breakfast was another stew, rich with gravy and fats and plump grains of rice. The people here wanted the slaves to have strength. That was something to consider, Sam mused as he ate. Whoever was doing this, and for whatever purpose, they valued the slaves and wanted them to survive. The guards very likely would be reluctant to kill or disable. And hesitation on their part might give a man valuable seconds of safety when it came time for him to make his break. He glanced down toward the heavy ball that was so firmly attached to his leg and frowned. He darn sure was not going to outrun anybody, not while he was carrying that thing. Coronado touched Sam lightly on the elbow to gain his attention.
Obey. Always obey.
Thank you for your concern, brother.
The guards returned, and the men picked up their steel balls and formed a line at the door. As soon as the door was pulled open, they filed outside into the young daylight. Blue Runner and Sam came out last. The guards herded them toward the lip of the pit, toward the start of a narrow path that angled down the wall of the dig. The men in front stopped short, however, when Case Wilhelm appeared. The boss guard this time carried the thin flail instead of a shotgun. He wore a revolver on his hip. As Wilhelm came near, the older men quickly dropped to their knees, heads down and eyes averted. Blue Runner hesitated, then did the same. Sam looked at them, then at Wilhelm. The thought of kneeling to a bullying thug like this was abhorrent. His Cheyenne ancestry filled his chest with stubborn pride. Sam Two Wolves stood upright and proud while the others submissively knelt. This was what Cornado warned him about just a few moments earlier. Submit, obey, or suffer the consequences. The overseer's eyes locked with Sam's, and for a moment, the big man seemed almost pleased at this show of resistance. He glided nearer, and his expression hardened.
Down.
Sam bent, but only to place the iron ball beside his feet. He stood upright again, back straight, and chin held high. His eyes bored coldly into Wilhelm's.
You will learn. This I promise. You will learn.
The overseer walked around behind Sam. A streak of pain exploded across his shoulders as the bamboo flail struck with a viper's vicious speed. Sam steeled his nerves, determined he would not flinch, would not bend, would not kneel to this man. He closed his eyes and retreated deep inside his head, his thoughts directed to the chance of his people as he asked for courage. After a while, Sam no longer felt the beating. What he felt was Wyoming wind gentle on his face and the Wyoming sun warm on his brow. In his mind, he rose up to meet an eagle in the air and soared with it as the great bird swept majestically above the vast, grassy plains. Sam thought he could see his grandfather's approving face and his father's smile. Sam soared higher.
It is good to see you all again.
Saniba might not be all that big, but it was hot and dry and dusty, and by the time Matt finished talking to every human person and a pair of small dogs he found at the cantina end of town, he was dry and dusty himself. He headed back to Tim Rogers at his saloon for a beer and a little shade before tackling the livery end of town. Yes, sir, he was thinking as he got there, if he lived down here permanent, he would for certain sure want to trade his fine Stetson for a lightweight straw hat. He removed the Stetson and ran a hand through his hair as he entered the pleasant little saloon. Rogers was behind the bar as he had been when Matt talked to him earlier. Now Tim was speaking with a tall, smiling gent who was leaning his elbows on the bar and huddling over a brandy snifter like he was protecting it. Not that he needed to, of course. There were only three other customers nearby, and they were paying no attention whatsoever to Tim and his friend. The clutch of three men standing belly up to the bar were all rough-dressed and rough-looking. There was something about them that suggested they were muscle hired by someone here, or perhaps were down on this side of the border to evade the law back in the States. One in particular appeared to fancy himself as a gunfighter. At least, he dressed the part. He wore a flat-crowned brown hat, filthy yellow brocade vest, and knee-high muleskinner boots that should have been put out to pasture years ago. He wore two guns, each slung very low on his thighs with the holsters strapped down tight. It was a look meant to inspire fear. Matt thought it was silly. And awfully impractical if the idiot ever got into a real-life gunfight. Carrying those guns extra low like this man did was a telltale giveaway of his ignorance. Guns carried down there have to be held in the holster by some means, usually a thong looped over the spur of the hammer. If the weapon is not carefully contained, it can drop out onto the ground whenever its owner sits in a chair, takes his seat on a saddle, or especially when a horse he might be riding gets into a storm. In short, whenever his leg is in anything other than a straight up and down posture. The thong works well enough to avoid that, but when trouble is expected, the thong can be slipped off and pushed out of the way. But then, trouble does not always come when it is expected. Matt frowned when he saw that this man did indeed use short bits of wang leather thong to hold his guns in place. And right now, those thongs had been rucked aside. Of course, it could simply be that he had the habit of carrying them like that until he decided to mount a horse or climb stairs or otherwise cause those holsters to leave the perpendicular. It could be. But then it could be that there would be a blizzard on the 4th of July, too. Matt did not believe that either. He angled toward the other end of the bar. Tim excused himself from the smiling gent and turned toward Matt.
What do you have, friend?
Beer, I reckon. That's all I need, thanks.
Tim drew the foamy beer.
Did you find your brother or do any good looking for Pete?
Not yet.
Matt placed a nickel in U.S. money onto the bar and buried his nose in the suds. The beer cut through the dust in his throat and tasted mighty good. When he looked up again, he saw that the fellow who thought himself a gunfighter was ambling over toward him.
Did he say you're the fellow that's looking for Pete Branville?
That's right.
The gunfighter stopped about 3 paces short of Matt and stood facing him instead of turning to the bar.
I might be able to help you.
I'd appreciate it if you could.
I ran into Pete a few days ago. About a week? Could be a little less.
Yes?
Matt took another sip of his beer and set the mug back onto the bar. He turned and leaned his left elbow beside the mug, which had him more or less facing the gunfighter.
Did Pete happen to say where he was going?
Matter of fact, mister, he did. He told me he was done with this country. Said he was tired of Mex lingo and runny-nosed kids. Pete said he was pulling up stakes and drifting on. Said something about California, or maybe going on up to Canada for a fresh start.
Is that a fact?
Yes, it is. Pete's gone from this country. No need for you to look for him no more.
Thanks for the information, but I expect I'll keep on looking for him.
There's no need for that. I'm telling you, he's pulled out. Gone. He left that little Mex tart and her half-breed kids.
Mister, I don't know why you want me to believe that, but it isn't working. I know that isn't the truth.
The man bristled and squared his shoulders, scowling.
Are you calling me a liar?
Not at all. You could simply be misinformed. You might have a very strange sense of humor and be trying to pull a practical joke on me. Of course, the possibility always exists that you could indeed be a liar. But I wouldn't know that, would I?
You'll take that back, mister, or you'll face me. And you best know one thing. I'm the fastest gun in this whole country.
Matt straightened to his full height. He checked the gunfighter's companions at the other end of the bar. They, Tim, and the pleasant-faced gent all shifted quietly aside to be out of the line of fire. But none of them appeared to be taking a hand in whatever this was.
Maybe you were the fastest until I got here.
Last chance, mister. Backwater or die.
The gunfighter bent slightly at the waist and moved his feet a little farther apart so he was in a crouch, ready to sweep his guns out of their holsters. His fingers curled in anticipation of grabbing the butts of the revolvers. He looked to be strung so tight, he would make a sound like a violin if someone ran a bowstring over him. Matt was unfazed. He stood normally, to all outward appearances relaxed. His hands hung calmly at his sides.
I think we have more choices than that, you and me. We don't have to drag iron here. We can talk about this. Or you can... how did you put it? You can back water. Which probably would be the sensible thing for you to do.
Me? You want me to backwater? Why, for 2 cents, Two cents?
I have that much in my pocket. You can have it if you want. I'd rather you just go on and leave me in peace to finish my beer and go on looking for my brother. But if you want those 2 pennies, mister, they're yours, if you're man enough to take them. Fists, guns, knives, however you like it.
Matt truly hoped the man would walk away. He knew that was not possible, though. The fellow had made his brag and his threat where others could hear. Now he had to grab for his guns, if only to show that he was not a coward. It seemed a pity. The gunfighter's expression twisted into a vicious sneer. He had no thought of losing, it was clear. Such a thing never entered his mind because he was, after all, the fastest gun around. Or so he believed. His right hand flashed with the speed of a striking snake. Matt stood poised, waiting to see if anyone else wanted to mix into this. No one did. One of the men who had been with the gunfighter turned and ran out of the saloon. Tim, the bartender, and the other 2 men stood in stunned silence for a moment, then they came forward. The rough-looking fellow who had been with the gunfighter dropped to his knees and peered down at his friend. The gunfighter's mouth opened, and Matt thought he was going to speak. But the light of life in his eyes was snuffed out, and the only thing to come out of his mouth was a trickle of blood that ran across his cheek and into his ear. Matt wanted quite badly to eject the spent brass from his Colt and reload those chambers, but he did not want to do it while these others were there. For the moments it would take to reload, the Colt would be inoperative, and Matt did not want to find himself disarmed among these strangers.
Sorry about this. He didn't give me a choice.
Two boys came hurrying in. They took the gunfighter by the hands and dragged him outside. Along with them was a young woman, little more than a girl, really, wearing a peasant blouse and a skirt that in Wyoming would have been scandalously short, but which here seemed to be normal attire. She brought sawdust and a broom and began cleaning up the blood. Matt got the impression this was not the first time blood had been spilled on this floor. The pleasant gent who had been talking with Tim earlier stepped forward, and Matt got the idea he intended to say something, but he was interrupted by the arrival of a Mexican army officer and two soldiers with bayonets mounted on their muskets. Matt looked at the officer's expression and definitely wished he'd had time to replace those expended cartridges in his Colt. The officer started forward with a scowl, but the tall gent stopped him with a touch on the officer's sleeve. Matt couldn't hear what was said and wouldn't have understood it anyway. The officer gestured to his men. The soldiers snapped to attention, saluted, and marched out the door and out of sight. The officer gave Matt a hard, speculative look, then he too turned and left. The pleasant-faced gentleman came forward.
I didn't mean to intrude, but I took the liberty of clarifying to Lieutenant Espinosa that you only fired in self-defense.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
The gent extended his hand.
I'm Gerald Williams. I live here. And you would be?
Bodine. Matt Bodine.
I will not say that meeting you is a pleasure, Mr. Bodine. Not under the circumstances. But you clearly had no choice. Curly forced the issue.
Curly. Did he have a last name?
Undoubtedly, but I never knew what it was. Perhaps one of his friends will know what to put on the marker.
Yes. I'll pay for the burying.
Oh, no need for that. I'll pay. Curly worked for me, you see. Burying him is the least I can do.
I see.
Now that Curly is dead, Mr. Bodine, I have an opening for a man with your rather spectacular abilities. I'd like to hire you, sir.
That's kind of you, Mr. Williams, but I've already got my plate full looking to find Pete Branville and hook up with my brother. He was supposed to meet me down here, and he hasn't shown up yet.
I see. Well, if you change your mind, Mr. Bodine, I'll not be hard to find. Come see me any time.
Thank you, sir. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go see the man at the livery, see if maybe he knows something about my brother, Pete.
William smiled and turned away. Matt looked around. Tim was busy behind the bar, and Curly's friends had left when the body was carried out. Matt stepped over to the bar and quickly reloaded his Colt. After all, a man never knows.